In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We let the circle be broken. From SDPB, today is Thursday, August 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, an award-winning bluegrass band is coming to the Lovett Band Shell in Sioux Falls. We talked with two members of Sister Sadie right before they hopped on the tour bus for South Dakota. Fiddler Deanie Richardson remembers and mourns for the Nashville of her childhood. And guitarist Danny Flowers talks about writing something from nothing. We'll bring you their voices in an interview and in a song later in the hour. But first, we're going to head east of Wall to meet a modern cowgirl and the director who spent years trying to tell her story. Director Kate Beecroft kicks off the show. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Director Kate Beecroft wasn't sure which state she was in when she met Tabitha Zemiga. She and her crew had taken a wrong turn on their wanderings through the country. She also wasn't sure what she wanted out of the filmmaking odyssey. Maybe a bid for a short film? Instead, what she found a little east of Wall was a group of women with stories that had to be told. And Beecroft told them in a new feature film. East of Wall premieres in South Dakota in a few weeks. Lori Walsh connected with Beecroft over Zoom.
So me and my cinematographer, we were just driving around the U.S. We had a camera with us. We weren't thinking, oh, I'm going to make a feature. This is my first feature. So I didn't think this was going to be my moment at all. I really had no resume. So I was just like, all right, maybe we'll have a camera and we'll shoot like little snippets that could go on my Instagram for my reel. And hopefully someone hires me for a little short film or, you know, so it was so innocent. And we were thinking so small. Kind of the purest intentions. And so when we got a feature, we were like, oh my God, this is so not what we were looking for, but wow, we have to go with this. Driving for days and days in like 114 degree heat. And we ended up being in South Dakota. That wasn't our plan. And we took a wrong turn into a tiny town called Oryx. I met a woman there and I filmed her for the day. And then after we left, we got a phone call from her and her daughter saying, if you want a really amazing story, head east of Wall and you'll find Tabitha Zemiga waiting for you. And that's what we did. Turned the car around and we pulled into her ranch. And yeah, it really struck me because, you know, it's one of, I mean, you see them all the time in South Dakota, but for me, it was a little different, but seeing these incredible old, like, historic homesteading ranches where everything's, like, kind of, like, also, like, collapsed, you know, and you have all this, like, farm equipment that is from hundreds of years ago, you know, and It's amazing to see. So you're basically in this, like, museum, and then all of a sudden these kids and Tabitha step out of their trailer, and they were so modern and against this kind of romanticized Western backdrop. And they immediately just like jumped out at me. And I was just like, wow, you are people I've never seen before in the best way possible. Like the girls were so fierce and amazing.
You set that up in the opening shot where we see this, you know, it's Portia on a horse and you see this Western. I mean, this is a Western in a lot of, I mean, it is a Western in all ways. In fact, at one point Tabitha says, welcome to the new West to a character. Because you open with the sweeping landscape and the cinematography, and we know our light is amazing here, so we see it every day. But you show the audience this amazing light, and then it cuts into this TikTok reels and contemporary music and everything that's sort of thrumming along with this modernization and how they're experiencing the West through the lens of their camera phones. In some ways, too. She sells horses on TikTok. What was her social media presence before you met her?
Yeah, she sells horses on TikTok, but then she also just makes like, Tabitha's a director in her own right. Like her TikToks are so fun and they are so stylized. And yeah, she like will do, you know, she just basically wants people to see real cow, real cowgirl stuff and real cowboy stuff. Because she's just so sick of seeing everything so polished. So she makes just like some crazy videos of just all the naughty, crazy, wild things that happen at the ranch. And yeah, and so I wanted to really incorporate her lens into it. And because I lived with this family for 3 years before I even shot the movie, just to know everything about them, that's when I came up with the idea of like, I have to have TikTok in there, and I have to have like shaboozy, like rap music, like, because this is Tabitha's heartbeat. That's her playlist that she listens to when she's breaking, you know, breaking horses, or when she's at the rodeo with the girls. And so I really wanted her style in there and how she views the world. So it's not me coming in and basically like making my idea of how I think she sees the world. I really wanted it to be her. And that, so she was my biggest collaborator. Making film.
And it's not a straight documentary. There is a script, there's a narrative, there are paid actors that come in to play roles that don't necessarily represent real characters. Tell us a little bit about the intersection between fiction and nonfiction in this film.
Yeah, so this film is a hybrid. It is technically, sure, it's docufiction because it is inspired by these people's lives. But, you know, I hope when people go see it, they're just like, oh, this is just a movie. You know, this is not a documentary. This could be reach everybody. And my background is I was an actor. So I taught Tabitha and her family how to act. And then from there, I made a script where I weave together stories that they've shared with me from the past, and then things that I've witnessed over the 3 years of living with them. I've known them now for 6 years almost. And then I had some fiction weaved through, and that's some of the, you know, the bigger named Hollywood actors who are playing alongside them. And a lot of people do ask why I didn't make a documentary out of this. And my answer every time is because I think they're more than that. These people are artists, and they're amazing actors, and it's always a no-brainer. And then of course someone said, hey, you could make more money, get more money for this budget if it was a professional actor playing Tabitha, playing Portia, playing these kids, because they're, quote unquote, the strong women that everyone wants to see in Hollywood. And I was like, no, I want these actual women who are strong and who are, you know, you can't fake being able to ride horses your whole life. You can't fake that, you know, the rancher manual labor lifestyle is inside of their bones. That's been passed down from generations. You can't just plop someone in from New York or LA and have them play Tabitha Zuniga.
Badlands. The Badlands are also a character in this. Tell me a little bit about finding a way to weave that in, that narrative in, that poetry in, the soundscape of the Badlands that sort of intersects with the galloping of hooves and grief as it crashes down on Portia. How did those scenes all get woven into the narrative?
Yeah, well, I really wanted to have the Badlands in as a huge part because they live right outside of the Badlands. So it's like, that's their backyard. And to me, that's just amazing to have something that like, it's almost like having a dinosaur in your backyard, you know? It's so like mythic and huge. It's almost like I always call it the sleeping giant that's just next to you. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to add the Badlands in there because there is something so magical about them. And yeah, and then with Portia, I wanted to use, I've always been really interested in how young kids, especially in the age around 12 to 14, how they process grief. When they don't have the language, but they're aware enough to understand what is going on. And so I manifest that by just understanding how Portia handles her grief. She has a hard time expressing her grief. It usually comes into something physical, which you see in the film. So I was like, all right, what's it feel like? And it feels like you're suffering. It feels like you're suffocating. It feels like everything is crumbling down around you. And so that's when I weaved through with Portia this Badland idea. And I really love films with magical realism. And so I put that into the script. And actually, it wasn't in the script because I know that most people would be like, what is this? So I always knew I was going to do it. And I put it in post. So when we were editing the film, that was my little thing that I always knew I was secretly going to do. That was a secret between me, my DP, and Portia. Yeah, but it was just how young kids handle grief when you don't know how to express it.
Yeah, so you were able to hold that close to your heart, really, before releasing it. Yeah, oh, that's beautiful. Her community doesn't accept her. She's not there's a loneliness and outsider quality to Tabitha that I think you portray really in a nuanced way. Tell me a little bit about how to navigate that when some of that is based on her real community.
Yeah, it is based on her real community. I think that, you know, people are so quick to judge. Tabby is, she has that hard exterior. She doesn't look like most, you know, rancher women in South Dakota. Her head's half shaved. She has tattoos. She's wearing something that's like, you know, definitely gonna turn heads. And to me, that was a really interesting character. That's almost her armor. Or when Tabby puts on her makeup, she said it's her war paint. And I think it protects her because she's in control of it.
Right.
And so that was a very interesting, you know, thing about Tabby that I really wanted to put into the film in a delicate way, you know. And I think we live in a world where we're all so quick to judge. And so, but the second that, you know, you meet Tabitha, everyone falls so in love with her because she is truly the most intelligent, funniest, smartest, warmest woman that I've ever met. And so, you know, once she allows you in, you see that side. But I wanted to change, you know, kind of change the narrative of how we look at women, you know. And she always says that she loves that people don't assume that she's a rider.
Mm-hmm.
She can do that. She could sort cattle like I've never seen before. I've seen this woman do some of the craziest things, still wearing the exact same outfit. Yeah. So I wanted to change that. I know Tabby also wanted to change that too. So that was something, you know, we talked about, and she's very open. She understands that people look at her and think one thing, and she loves to just use that to twist it and be like, yeah, don't judge me, get to know me. Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away about the story because it's a very powerful scene, but there is a scene where there are a group of women who are telling their stories, and it is really compelling when women sit in a circle and share stories of domestic violence, of survival, of grief, of trauma. And I'm wondering what you can share with us about filming that scene, because it had to have been incredibly difficult and powerful to be a part of the sequence itself.
That was the most difficult scene. I had it in the script as it wasn't scripted. It was the only thing in the script that said this will all be improvised. So every filmmaker has a scene during, you know, that they wrote, or I mean, sorry, during pre-production that they're thinking, oh God, three more days until I shoot this. One more day until I shoot this. Oh God, we're shooting it today. And that was that scene for me, because it was all improvised, that if it didn't go right, I'm screwed. You know, that to me, that's the heart of the film, is that scene. And especially all these women, they've never had cameras in front of their faces while they're telling their deepest stories of their lives, you know. And, but, you know, it was probably 4 a.m. we were shooting that, and they were all, I basically, like, we opened it up of just being like, let's do this for other women. And that was just me and the women in a group. No one was in the room. And I said, let's just do this for your younger self. And that kind of changed the course of how that night went. And, you know, I'm always so struck by these women have gone through the most horrific things imaginable, but they always find laughter in their survival and where they are now. And they use humor in a way that is both heartbreaking, but also so honest. And that is how we cope. And so, all of that was really just done in one take. I had multiple cameras. And I mean, at one point we have our amazing camera operators. They were shaking because they were crying so much. And just so honored that these women shared their story. And that was also the first time Tabitha, she's only ever told that story to me once, the day I first met her.
Wow.
This was the second time she's ever told it. And I knew how much that would take out of her. So I said, we're just doing this in one take. And everyone looked at me like I was crazy, but I was like, I'm never going to ask her to do this again. And now she's very proud that she did it.
Yeah.
Healed her in some sense.
How did you recover from that scene then, as a group collectively?
Absolutely. You know, that is something me and Tabby would do check-ins constantly throughout this film. Tabitha is my best friend to this day. I speak to her 5 times a day, every day for the past like 6 years. So yeah, those women are all women. They all know Tabby, but they're all women that I placed there because they've all been embraced me in their community. And so I was like, I want to honor all these women and all their stories. And they were so, when I first met them, they, you know, there was something about a filmmaker, me being anonymous. It was almost like a therapist because I'm not connected to their life. The openness that people really wanted their stories heard and told, it was something that really was so special and blew me away that people were so willing and to be open with me. And be like, hey, this is what happened to me. Can I tell you? Nobody knows this. And so, you know, we talked a lot about that. And that's like why I said in the beginning, like, let's do this for your younger self. You know, and that's what Tabby wants people to take away from the film too, is like, you can get through this. You know, you have to have that grit, but you can't get through this. And those women are, I love them so much, and they were just so brave to do this. And I think they were really excited to have their voices heard, for the first time, unfortunately, in a long time.
I mentioned the lighting. Tell me what it's like to film in South Dakota.
Well, you know, when I told you, I was like, I didn't even really know I was in South Dakota at one point. Like when I first found this story, because we were like, I think we're in Nebraska. I don't know where we are. Like everything was blurring, and then I was like, I remember I turned to my DP. I was like, okay, where are we actually? Because this lighting is amazing. And I was like, oh yeah, of course we're in South Dakota. I've heard about this amazing light. South Dakota is always just like such a gift because you also never know what you're going to get weather-wise, and that's super exciting. I mean, horrifying for when you're filming, but it's also for me super exciting because I'm like, ooh, I could get a crazy lightning storm today, or I can get, you know. And so yeah, I mean, the land plays a huge character in this film because for me, I wanted to show that, like, you know, the stakes are so high for ranchers and their connection to land, because that's like, you know, generational wealth goes into land. The how you're going to feed your kids is based off of like the cattle in that land and the rain. If you don't have enough rain for the cat, you know, all these factors go into it. And so for me, after spending my years in South Dakota, I was like, I need to make the land a character because I think that's how South Dakotans think about their life, is land is a character. It's their friend or their foe, but it's going to get them through something. Yeah.
How has this film changed you? I mean, you've already said the friendships that you've built, but talk a little bit about bringing it to the public film festivals and getting the response, because that also has to have changed how you see yourself as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, I love to write, but when you're a young girl, I think a lot of people say go be an actress, because no one tells women to go be directors. And so I think I had total imposter syndrome for a long time because I was like, you know, it was honestly until I had the audience award in my hand at Sundance that I think, oh, maybe I am a filmmaker. And that makes me so sad, honestly.
Me too.
You know, but that's, you know, unfortunately what the system is for women, female directors. And yeah, because it was just like, well, I just made a film with, you know, my small tiny crew and people that I'm so in love with, and this was like movie summer camp and it was so fun. And then all of a sudden to see where it is now, that it was one of the, nothing got bought out of Sundance this year basically, and to have Sony buy our film at a Sundance, to win at Sundance, to get all these accolades, it's very overwhelming. Because I think I didn't go into it thinking, oh, this is a feature, you
Sure.
know? And like I said, when it was all very pure and the intentions were just like, hey, I love being with you. Like, let's like film some stuff, you know? Tabitha, just my years in South Dakota completely changed my life. It feels like it changed my DNA, changed the way I look at people, changed the way that I, yeah, want to spend the rest of my life, everything. It was the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, was living in South Dakota.
That was director Kate Beecroft discussing her new South Dakota-focused film, East of Wall. The movie will premiere at the Sioux Falls State Theater on August 12th. There will be a live filmmaker Q&A after the screening. You can learn more at our website. That's sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester. You just heard a bit of the song Willow by Sister Sadie. The all-female bluegrass band is performing at Leavitt at the Falls in Sioux Falls tonight. Lori Walsh spoke with fiddler Deanie Richardson and guitarist Danny Flowers ahead of their performance. They connected via Zoom.
This band is 13 years old. We started as a group of women who had known each other our whole lives 13 years ago, but never really played together in that configuration. And we decided we wanted to get together and just have a jam sort of performance at the Station Inn here in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a December night 13 years ago. And from the first note we hit, we all kind of looked at each other's mouth, fell open. Oh my gosh, this feels like we've been playing together forever. And it was just this bond and this sisterhood from the first note we played. Played that show and decided it'd be fun to do another one. And never had any intention of touring, traveling, making records, never any of that. And just kind of organically happened. People started calling saying, hey, I heard you guys from the Station Inn, would love to have you here at my show. And went and played a few shows and then had a record label call and say, we all want to do a record. And then we were like, oh my gosh, okay, well, that wasn't the plan, but sounds fun. So we went and did a record and then got nominated for all these IBMA awards, International Bluegrass Music Association, and then got nominated for a Grammy. And we were like, oh my gosh, maybe we should go all in and see what happens with this thing. So that's kind of what we've done. We've had personnel changes along the way, but I feel with every person that left and every person that came in, it was a much needed change. And the energy shifted into this beautiful thing of where we are now.
Yeah.
It's just a great group of women. I always say all of the ingredients in the soup feel right. And it's just a beautiful thing to hit the road with these ladies.
Did you have a name right away?
We didn't have a name. The name we had that night is something I can't say on in public. So it was just a fun name we created. But later on, when we made the record, we decided we better have a name here. So we're all every show somebody comes up and asks who Sadie is, and we don't have a Sadie in the band. Sadie comes from the Tony Rice tune. We're all big fans of Tony Rice, bluegrass guitarist and singer. He had a song called Little Sadie. So we all love Tony and love that song, and we all just feel like sisters, and that's where the name came from.
Yeah, I was. Isn't there a Dr. Hook in the Traveling Medicine Show Sadie song too? And I was like, boy, I don't think it's that.
There's lots of them. There's a jazz tune called Sister Sadie as well.
All right. Yeah.
So yeah, there's lots of mysterious things out there that people think it is.
Danny, tell me a little bit about the first time you are here with these musicians and hearing the sound.
I actually have been a big fan of Sister Sadie since they started playing. And the first record that Sister Sadie had nominated for a Grammy, which is insane. I was not a part of the band yet, but they did record a song that I wrote on that record. So I've been a big fan of what they do for a very long time. And then Deanie actually called me, can never remember how many years ago it was. It was in 2022, I think, and asked me to come join the band. And I said yes immediately. And the first time I played with them was at the Station Inn. It was on November 11th, I remember. And it was the most magical thing.
So I love that it's the same venue,
yeah.
Same feeling. Same
yeah.
spark in some ways, but with different. Deanie, what's going on there? How is that possible?
I don't know. It's been this weird thing throughout the 13 years that when a new person comes in, their first show has either been the Station Inn or the Grand Ole Opry. And you talk about throwing people into the fire pit, and most of these girls have been very young that have come to us. So that's been... Ironically, with Jaylee, her first performance was the Opry. Our former bass player Maddie was the Opry. I think there's been several that their first thing was the Grand Ole Opry that they did with us or the Station Inn.
Yeah. Deanie, you're what, 13 when you first played the Opry? I mean,
Oh yeah, when I first played, yeah, I was like, now new.
not now.
Yes, my first performance,
Yeah.
I was 13 there, yes.
And you grew up near Nashville.
I am a unicorn, they call us.
Oh.
I am born and bred here, yes.
So what is that like in the sense that it's in some ways it feels like an advantage? And then in other way, because you just this is the soup that you're in, but then also it would seem like maybe not, you might not realize what you're a part of if you grew up there. I mean, some things just become like, oh, that's just Tuesday because or that's just Sunday morning. Tell me a little bit about that experience and then realizing it was special and people were coming from all over the world trying to get where you were already at.
Well, when I was first started going backstage to the Grand Ole Opry, I started playing at 9 years old. I was probably 12 or 13, 10, maybe, I was really young when I started going backstage there. When I grew up here in Nashville, it was a different Nashville. It was a different scene than it is now. So I had some really great people around me as a young kid who were very supportive, who would take me backstage to the Grand Ole Opry, who would let me get on stage at the Station Inn as a 10-year-old and play in a bar. I stayed up many nights past my bedtime at the Station Inn on a school night. So I grew up in this scene where it was at that point it was like Nashville was this cool music town, but not so much a big tourist town. It was just a cool music town. And I remember seeing my heroes on stage at the Opry, Loretta Lynn, Porter Wagoner, Dolly Parton, that era of country music, Bill Monroe. It was an amazing world to grow up in during the, early 80s.
Yeah.
And then at the Station Inn, I have so many memories and pictures of just being on stage and Robert Duvall's out in the audience. And it was just a magical time to be in Nashville, Tennessee. And now it's still the music town. It's still an amazing town. You can hear anything you want. It's just on a much bigger scale than it was then. And I was at the Opry Friday night when we lost one of my heroes, Jeanie Seely. And I just have been devastated about that because to me it feels like my Nashville, I'm gonna cry. My Nashville that I grew up in is not anymore, So, gosh, sorry.
No, it's a time for tears. Danny,
Yeah.
talk a little bit about those connections that you make with your heroes and in the role of music in honoring that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was thinking while Deanie was talking about her growing up here and your question, I think it depends like on the person. So Deanie growing up here in Nashville, being a child who loves music, I don't think it was lost on her. Like the crowd that I think every time she was at the Station Inn watching Mark O'Connor or whatever, she was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I grew up in the middle of nowhere in Illinois, like dreaming of moving to Nashville. And I knew I was going to live here one day and I was going to have a kid and they were going to be a Nashville native and that was going to be so cool. And, we have kids and to them, because they're not these like music lovers like Deanie and I were when we were kids. It's all just very whatever to them. They're like, oh, we're going on the Opry again. Oh, we're going to the Station Inn again. They have no idea the things that they're getting to see and witness and be a part of. Deanie got to grow up meeting her heroes at a really young age. I was quite a bit older when I moved to town and started to really be able to spend actual time and create things with my heroes. And those connections that you make with those people, especially when you grew up idolizing them, and then you're lucky enough to become friends with them and then stand beside them on stage or write a song with them in a room, that's like they become your literal family. And so to lose somebody like that, like Jeannie, or any of our heroes that we lose, it really feels like losing family.
Also feels like a chapter closing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that chapter
Like a
that.
whole generation is like shifting to a different, yeah.
Yeah, something is lost, and there are people here to notice it and that
Yeah.
to witness
And
it.
you never get it back. Like,
Yeah.
I spent many nights on stage with Jeannie Seely at the Grand Ole Opry. I'm leaving this interview in a minute to go to the Grand Ole Opry to play tonight. And the thoughts that, because she was, for me, was the last one from that, my childhood, you know, that I remember walking out. Loretta's gone. I remember her walking out. And so I'll never see Jeannie walk out on that stage again. So that's just a thing for me. I feel like I'm grieving not only the loss of her, but just the loss of that time period of me being so fortunate to have grown up in this magical place of country music.
Yeah. So, Deanie, tell me about the when you play fiddle then, is that how is that showing up in your body? I mean, because you've played through loss, you're going to play through joy, you're going to play through political upheaval, you play through, I'm sure, people throwing things at the stage, maybe even in certain venues.
Yeah.
What's happening when you're playing that makes that somehow okay or.
A great question. I mean, I grew up in a very volatile family. One of our songs was written about, my experience with my dad.
I'm gonna break out a Ouija board and call some spirits up and sit here face to face with the darkness in my blood. It didn't start with me, but this is where it stops.
So for me,
Gonna cut that
that piece of
twist
wood that I hold up
gently.
here under my chin was always an escape, or that sounds wrong. It was always a place for me to be safe. It was always the safety. I could put that thing under my chin and walk on a stage, and I am safe, and I am madly in love with this piece of wood, and I get to throw every emotion that I have into it, and then it comes out of these F holes into a microphone or into this audience. And so for me, it's just it's a beautiful place that I get to go. And every time I play, be it on stage with these girls or be it on stage at the Grand Ole Opry, it is just home to me. It feels like the safest place I've ever known.
And watching Deanie play the fiddle is freaking magical. It's like you can be in the crowd watching her play, and you're like, dang, it looks like she is putting every single ounce of everything she has into it. And when you're lucky enough to be on stage with her and see like the come down after, you're like, dang, she really did. Because there's like, she's so worn out. There's nothing left. Like, there's no question when you're watching her play that everything she's like felt that day or like in her whole life, it feels like she's, is coming through the fiddle. It's pretty amazing.
Danny, talk to me about songwriting and how that works for you, what you put in, what you hold back, what you couldn't hold back if you tried.
Well, I feel like for me, songwriting is more of like, I wouldn't say this if I weren't doing this. Like, if I weren't writing a song right now, I don't think, like, maybe my specific personality type, I would think that this is something I have to get out of me. So it's almost like I don't think about that until I sit down with like a blank page or a blank piece of paper, and then I'm like, oh, this is a good place for that to go, is in this song. Whereas otherwise, I probably would just hold it in and not think about it or get it out in any way. So I think just that the fact that I ever was lucky enough to discover songwriting is like a huge blessing for me, because I think all of those, all the turmoil, all the things, even the happy stuff, that I write about sometimes, I think it would all still be stuck in there.
Do you have listeners, audience members, either at a live show or someone who's bought an album connect with you and say, hey, this song touched me, helped me escape something that I was trying to get away from? Danny, if you want to start with that, and then we'll ask Dean the same question. Like, what is some of the response from listeners that your music has really shifted something for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the two most amazing feelings that I've ever felt as a songwriter are, one, I was with a friend of mine recording a live album. He was recording different songs from different records at a live show in Green Hall in Texas. And he, you know, said at all of his shows, this one song that we wrote together goes over really well. And it's like the slowest, saddest, most miserable duet you've ever heard in your entire life. And he would normally sing it by himself, because he doesn't have a girl on the road, but he invited me to come sing it with him. And as we were singing it, the entire sold out, like, Green Hall was singing every single word to the entire song. And never in my life have I ever experienced that before or after, honestly. But that was pretty incredible. And then, you know, we do have nights where, which I'm sure Jeannie will talk about as well. One of our more recent singles, Let the Circle Be Broken, is one that we get a lot of audience response from. And it's such a heavy topic, and it's something that we even sort of questioned if it was something that we should write about, sing about, you know, put out into the world. And we get all kinds of responses from that one, and they're always very moving in one way or another. And in a way that you can tell that the song really touched this person. That's just, for me, incredible to think that something, you know, we sat in a room with nothing, came out with this, and it's like affected, you know, more than a handful of people, is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah. Deanie, what would you add to that?
I would add to that song, particularly, you know, we wrote that about my abusive father right after he died. I mean, we've all experienced some sort of abuse, all of us writers, in that tune. But right after he died, we got together and this tune just fell out of all of us. And there is never a night where someone doesn't come up to us and either tell us their experience, or they're singing along out there, they're crying. It's just a very emotional tune for me, but it's also just watching how it's touching so many people, or so many people have experienced the same situation. I even had a person the first weekend we did this tune, if you remember this, Danny, we were in California, and this woman comes up to me and said, thank you for doing that tune. I haven't spoken to my son in years, and I was the abuser.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so to hear both sides of this thing. And she said, you know, and I've since had a lot of therapy, a lot of help, but her son wasn't ready to repair that relationship, and she was. So that was, you know, you could feel the pain and the hurt and the remorse, you know, from her, and her desire to just rekindle some sort of relationship with her son after she hurt him so brutally.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So that was the most powerful thing I've experienced. Lots of people come up and say they know this, you know, they felt it, they've lived it. But for the abuser to come up and say that was powerful.
Yeah. I feel like I have a question that I'm not quite sure how to formulate, but the accolades that you've received, the Grammy nomination, I think it might be very standard for people to, you know, to focus on, look at these powerful women, look at this, you know, thing that they've done, but the skill and the craftsmanship and the talent and the everything that you bring to the table in music that crosses genres, really, in a lot of ways. I'm wondering what the awards mean to you.
Great question. Wow. Yeah. I mean, of course, you're extremely honored, very flattered, and it's it's, you know, what's the word? You know, to go and write song from for me and Danny, a lot of these things start with us and a piece of paper sitting in a room looking at each other and another person maybe just with an idea. And then to take that idea and make a song out of it, and then to take that song to the girls, and then to arrange it, and then to take it to the studio, and then to record it, get it out to radio, you guys play it, and then to receive any sort of accolade for that sort of journey of a song or an idea or a feeling. You know, you talk about validation and just not so much winning the award, but just acknowledging, whoa, we heard this and it was powerful. And you know, we felt something with you. So for me, that's the biggest accomplishment is, you know, not just throwing music out there, but really touching people, having people come up to you and say something about it, or having people sing along in an audience, or getting nominated for an award, you know, or one of your peers coming up and saying, oh my gosh, that just slayed me, you know. Those are the things that I don't know, you just feel validated and like you're being heard, and like what you're doing is it matters, and not just to you, but to other people. That's a huge thing for me. I don't care if we win awards. I don't even care if we get nominated. I feel like this band has had a great run, and you know, we're heading to the IBMA Awards this year, and you know, not many nominations this year like previous years, but I just feel so grateful and so blessed and so honored to now cheer on our pals. And we released a great record. All Will Be Well, in my opinion, is the best thing we've put out, but it's not bluegrass. So, you know, we crossed some genres there, and I don't know. I'm just thrilled to be here. I know it sounds cliche, but just honored to be on the stage with these ladies. We're hitting the road tomorrow, hard and heavy for August, and can't wait to get up there and just bring what we're doing to you guys.
Danny, twice now I've heard one of you, each of you say, you know, a piece of paper, starting with a piece of paper. Since I don't make music, I write, but I don't write music. I imagine you starting with a melody. Tell us about starting with a piece of paper and an idea for, especially for singer-songwriters who are listening.
Yeah, so I think when I say like starting with a piece of paper, I mean like before the idea comes, like because we'll have times where, especially for co-writing, you know, someone will be like, oh, I have this idea I've been thinking, or I have this list of titles. Like if you're a pro songwriter, like you got a list of titles, you've got some melodies saved up, you've got some ideas. But before you had that, it really was nothing. Like you grasped that melody, that phrase, that idea from thin air, and then you maybe got together with your friends and put something together. I had this realization once when I was writing on Music Row. I had a publishing deal and I was writing every single day. And I was like, we really are walking into this room with nothing and leaving with a whole song, like melody, chords, lit rhymes, words, a message, you know. There's and to me, I don't know, it kind of blew my mind a little bit to think about that. And then to go so far as Deanie was explaining, for it to be nominated for an award, you know, to think about like the Grammys specifically as this like giant production that people know it of, and just like the mecca of music awards that you could win. And to think that it literally started from just like someone had a random thought, is, and then it turned into like a phrase and a song and a work tape and a recording and a record and a whole thing, is, I don't know, pretty cool to think about, especially if you're someone who cares about things like music, you know, like you think about your favorite songs and how they have, for me, shaped my life or taught me literal lessons in certain ways that they just came from nothing. I feel the same way about books, you know. How do you write 400 pages just from like an idea? That's crazy.
Never taking that creative process for granted.
Right.
Yeah, I love that. I know you have lots of things to do, so we can wrap up, but I wanted to tell you that I'm sitting across, our studios are pretty much across the street from where you will be playing. And Deanie, when you were talking about being in love with this piece of wood as your fiddle, there was a swallowtail butterfly right outside the window. And there aren't many of those. Like, you do not see those. It's very rare. There used to be more plentiful, of course, just flying around out there. And nice. That's never happened before. And so I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, thank you for doing that.
It's getting ready for you.
The venue looks gorgeous. I was looking at some pictures, and
I'm so excited.
It's like it's going to be a good night.
That was Deanie Richardson and Danny Flowers of Sister Sadie. The two-time Grammy-nominated bluegrass band is performing at Levitt at the Falls tonight. That's at 7 p.m. local time. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. We will end today's show with a bit of Sister Sadie's Let the Circle Be Broken. This is the song about Richardson's relationship with her father.
I won't go. I'll take the light, leave the bones, let the circle.